Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise, informative update. It's Monday, March the 25th, and coming up on the program, we'll explore the aftermath of the Marcus Huster suicide, and also this.
Today marks a historic moment for Action SA, as we take another step closer to 29 May 2024.
Action SA's manifesto promised to end load shedding in 2 years, the House Speaker's next move after her home is raided, and the role of local communities as the mining sector makes big tech changes. The suicide of former Steinhoff boss Marcus Huster will not have any impact on the ongoing investigation relating to fraud and misrepresentation at the JSE-listed retailer. That's according to the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. I want to explore this in a little more detail now as I'm joined by the former editor of the Financial Mail and author of the seminal book Steinheist, Rob Rose. Rob, a very warm welcome to you. Before we get to the aftermath, when you heard the news, were you shocked?
Afternoon, Jeremy. Good to speak to you again. Absolutely. I was completely shocked when I was told about it. I thought it might have been one of those conspiracy theories, but it soon became clear that that's what happened. So it was very bracing.
Does anyone, Rob, have any indication of the mood that he was in? He was all set to hand himself over, and then it took this very strange and tragic turn of events.
Yeah, I don't think he was all set to hand himself over. I think he was probably weighing up his options. He'd already had that fine earlier in the week from the regulator for $475 million, so he probably wasn't in the best of moods. But I think it was the news that the criminal investigation was actually closing in on him, and he'd been telling people for years that he never thought they'd actually get around to it. So I suppose the revelation that they were actually intending to arrest him was obviously what tipped him over the edge. I don't know if he would have happily handed himself over. I just don't think he expected it to get to the stage, and I suppose to some extent now we'll never know. He's never going to appear in front of a judge and plead his case.
It was in many ways an indication of his hubris, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he was somebody for whom, you know, he looked down on other people. He was quite scornful of other people's views, and I think that standing in front of a judge and having to explain what actually happened to Steinhoff and concede his error, I think would have clashed up heavily against his hubris and his personality, which had, you know, he'd never actually conceded reality in many, many parts of this case, which is why the fraud got to the stage it did.
Rob, I know that we're going to step now into the realm of conjecture, but what would have happened or what could have happened had he turned himself in last week as might have been the case?
So he and Stian Grobler, who was Steinhoff's company secretary for many years, were ordered to appear in court on Friday, and Stian Grobler did appear in court. And I think this morning he did get bail, partially from what I understand, because the state's case isn't 100% complete. So I think that Marcus Huster, the state would have argued against bail, but he probably would have got bail on the argument that, you know, he's had 6 years and he hasn't run anywhere. So he probably would have got bail, and then it would have led to a long standoff, probably many years, while the case dragged on to trial. Jeremy, if you remember the case of Tigon, which is one of the largest 40 companies on the JSE, its CEO was arrested in 2002, and that trial still isn't complete. So, you know, it could have dragged on for many, many more years. But he would have faced charges of fraud and charges of breaching the Financial Markets Act, and it would have been quite a lengthy trial.
What does this say, Rob, about our ability or inability to effectively investigate financial crimes, such as the two that you've just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's been an issue for a number of years. Since the Scorpions disbanded, particularly, it's been a big issue. because Regal Bank, for example, in 2002, I think they managed to, the Scorpions arrested Jeff Levenstein, who was the CEO of Regal Bank, and he was sent to prison. But since then, we haven't had many big corporate crimes. In the case of Sambo, for example, its CEO and other directors, I think one of them actually died before it got to trial. So I think it's a big weakness, and it's one of those issues that I think the Financial Action Task Force mentioned last year, our inability to tackle financial crimes, which is one of the reasons we were greylisted. So the state, I think, realizes the importance of it, but doesn't have the skills to effectively do this. And I think, I mean, the jury is very much out on that.
I've referenced the Financial Sector Conduct Authority already. What happens now, in your opinion, in terms of this investigation? What direction does it take? What needs to change, if anything at all?
Well, I mean, that's really, I spoke to some of the investigators and they were saying that they now have to regroup and see what they do with this particular case, because they're going to have to focus on other people involved in Steinhoff. Certainly there was a big, I suppose, public demand that people be held accountable for this. And Stian Hrobler and potentially other people being held in the dock will certainly provide some degree of accountability, but it won't provide the sort of national cleanse that having Marcus Uster in the dock would have. So I think you'll still want the criminal cases to go on, and I think you'll still want them to hold people accountable. And in terms of the Financial Sector Conduct Authority, that particular fine of $475 million will be lodged against his estate. And, I mean, I doubt they'll get that money back, partially because I'm quite skeptical over whether Marcus Uster actually has that money sitting in an account in South Africa. So I'm not sure if they'll ever get that money back. But to some extent, I think the size of that fine was symbolic. I don't think they ever really expected to get that fine out of Marcus.
All of this is, of course, contained in your excellent book, Rob, Steinheist. But maybe give our audience a sense of the scale of the fraud that was perpetrated.
Sure, it was immense. It was, you know, the PwC investigators talked when they released their findings, which was, you know, a few months after the book came out. So I was quite nervous about the book to some extent, hoping that, you know, I hadn't got it wrong. But the PwC investigation found in the end that there was 106 billion rand of fictitious transactions over more than a decade. So actually the scale was larger than I think we anticipated. And essentially this runs the gamut from creating fictional companies in Europe and using it to send fake invoices to Steinhoff to boost the profits. You know, it extends far, far more than that. I mean, he did deals in which he himself personally benefited out of Steinhoff shareholders to the tune of millions. It was a large con that was by far the largest, exceeded Regal Bank, LeisureNet, all the big ones we've had in South Africa by some distance. And, you know, I think it cast the spotlight firmly on what our regulators do, what our boards of directors do. And, you know, you had a board of directors at Steinhoff, which really was a superstar board with three accounting PhDs, and you had an accounting scandal, which does raise all kinds of questions of governance at this company.
I'm going to leave it there. And if you haven't read the book, Steinheist, the author is Rob Rose. And Rob, thank you very much for joining me. Now, 3 years ago, Benguela Global Fund Manager's Chief Investment Officer, Zwelakhe Mguni, laid criminal charges against Marcus Uster. And at the time, if memory serves, also called for the interim Steinhoff chief at the time, Christo Wiese, to step down. I want to get some reaction now after the dramatic suicide last week. Zwelakhe Mguni, a very warm welcome to you. Firstly, what was your reaction when you heard the news?
Good afternoon. I thought it was quite unfortunate. I mean, I thought there was a lot of information that was owed to South Africa to make sense of the losses. And while I had very little expectation in terms of recouping the losses, I just thought that justice would be served by just being candid about the developments there and ventilating the entire matter to the South African public.
Whatever became of the charges that you laid?
The charges are running smoothly. As you saw, somebody got arrested last week. It's part of that whole process. So I have engaged with the police on an ongoing basis and getting feedback from them. And I think I would say that without speaking on their behalf, I mean, I think I'm comfortable with the way that they handled the matter. Their approach was that they need to basically investigate the case and gather all the evidence, or at least most of the evidence, before they go and charge in court. Because typically what happens then is, in a case as complicated as this, you don't have all your ducks in a row, and then the case gets thrown out of court because you're taking too long to present it. Essentially, you then, if you bring it back again, it becomes very hard because the person can say that they are a victim. So I think from that angle and the updates that I got, I mean, I was expecting an arrest from the updates I got last month. And so I think the police have been very diligent in that regard.
But the fact that he's dead now, does that make any difference to where this is going?
Absolutely not. There are five accused or co-accused. There were five of them, the accused. So one is gone. There's four of them that still remain accountable. There's a lot that that has been uncovered. And I think if you look at the FSCA report of last week, essentially the facts are, it's a hard facts that they put on the table. And I think a lot has been derived from the benefit of the police investigation, the FSCA own investigation, but also I think the PwC report probably would have helped to some extent if it was made public.
Now, if I'm correct, your fund at the time didn't have any exposure to Steinhoff, but my question is still pertinent. How do you think it was that so many people were duped by this?
Look, I think on our part, probably there's a bit of luck, but I think the big thing was, at least the things that stood out for us, were that the tax rate didn't make sense. And I did write to Marcus Yoste and his team to basically ask them, how do they get to a 15% tax rate? And that they mentioned something to the effect of a buying group. And that's when I really got unsettled. And then there was also the cash flow. If you take the cash flow statement and look at it compared to what was reported in the earnings, and the gap was wide and kept becoming wide. And I think most people focused on what was reported in the earnings, which was going up continuously, and the M&As were being used to basically buy those earnings. But from a cash flow point of view, nothing was coming through.
All right, Zwelak Mguni, thank you very much indeed for joining me. This is MoneyWeb at Midday.
MoneyWeb at Midday, for all your up-to-date stories.
Noziviwe Mapisa Nkula, the National Assembly Speaker, who's now on special leave, has filed court papers to interdict the National Director of Public Prosecution, Shamila Batoi, the Police Minister, Becky Cele, and investigators from arresting her. Let's push the story a little further. With me now is her attorney, Stephen May. And first of all, Stephen May, can you confirm that papers have been filed? And if so, what are you seeking?
Papers have been filed. We're in court. There was an initial set of papers, an urgent application that was filed on more sober timelines, in which we sought the disclosure of the state brief. So a very broad category of documents that would feed into the state's investigation. In fact, everything that constitutes the state's investigation. Oftentimes, it's not all placed into the state docket, and it gets put in other ancillary files and things, including sort of informer dockets and the like. The reason we seek that is that we have a very strong, well-founded suspicion that the case against my client is in fact a non-case, a non-entity, and that she shouldn't be required to be called into the dock to answer the case because there simply isn't one against her. We believe that it's based on inadmissible and unreliable evidence of a tainted Section 204 witness.
So, Stephen May, what leads you then to that conclusion that it is a non-event?
Well, I'll give you the cliff notes. These are old allegations that emanate from a witness who was in the process of being prosecuted in the Commercial Crimes Court. For some inexplicable reason, very deep into that prosecution, a long way into her having been brought to court and facing those charges, a decision was taken at some level to offer her potential indemnity in exchange for giving evidence against my client. Section 204 is a provision of this Criminal Procedure Act, which allows the state to offer a form of conditional indemnity to a witness where they can implicate themselves, and provided they give frank and honest evidence, when they do come and give evidence, they then get indemnified from the matter in which they're giving evidence. Obviously, this is subject to the usual cautionary rules of evidence of a single witness and of confessions and so on.
So, Stephen May, what I'm hearing is a questioning of the timing, because your client also put a statement out saying the conduct of the state representatives is, and I quote, indicative of an abuse of process at an opportunistic time. That's the important bit, before the national election. Could you amplify that for me, please?
Well, if you consider that this witness, her matter has been on the Commercial Crimes Court roll, was on the Commercial Crimes Court roll, since at least 2020, the state's representatives have obviously waited until now to come to court, or rather not to come to court, but to approach her and offer her indemnity. So for all this period of time, she was seen as the primary target of their investigation and their prosecution. But for some other reason, at this stage now, she became secondary, and they offered her indemnity in exchange for evidence that she is now giving against my client. And obviously the upcoming elections and the ANC's step aside rule, one would have to be mindful that that is the timing in which they've sought to come to court now, sought to bring my client to court now.
Who does she believe is out to get her?
It's speculation. I don't know. I mean, you would realize that obviously the coincidental timing of this is one thing. Now, whether that's not the primary basis of the relief we seek. As to who's out to get her, we simply don't know. What we can say is that there's a serious stink around the case, that it appears to be based solely on the evidence of a single witness who's been offered indemnity for her own charges. And we would like to see exactly what informed that, what was offered to this witness, and precisely what evidence she's actually giving. As to the timing of it, and as to, you know, who's out to get her, and sort of whether it can be construed as a sort of conspiracy theory is extraneous. And perhaps it can, but that's not really the primary basis of the relief that we're seeking. If the state has nothing to hide, they should simply give us the information we're asking for.
Stephen, is your client angry? Does she feel betrayed?
I can't speak to my client's feelings about it. It's not really a question of how one feels and so on. It's a question of the operation and the rule of law. If she does feel betrayed, I certainly wouldn't blame her. But I can't speak to my client's feelings.
I do understand that. The reason why I asked you that question is that she did claim in a statement that her expected prosecution was, and again I quote, similar to the atrocities of the apartheid government. Those are strong words. Are you able to throw more light on that statement?
Well, look, I can only speak for myself. I'm not speaking for my client now. But during the apartheid era, now I'm a bit young for this, but those that have trained me and mentored me were around and have taught me a lot about it. And I also have the view that many of our institutions carry with them so-called institutional DNA, or perhaps the corporate culture is a better word, and that those who were around during apartheid trained their successors and so on. And we still have some of the hangover of that. Now, during apartheid, the country was what is known as a security state, and the tactics of the security state were angled around pre-trial oppression. Their tactics were all aimed at crushing an accused person pre-trial without the mechanisms that are available now by virtue of Section 35 and others, Section 34, Section 32, Section 12 of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that protect us from these things. In other words, there are now standards of a fair trial and standards of a fair investigation, because no trial can ever be fair unless there is a fair investigation that leads into it and that feeds into it, and that the evidence that is led in the trial was obtained fairly. And much of what is happening here smacks of the tactics that were used, using 204 witnesses who were sort of conscripted to give evidence on the basis of a promise, conducting search and seizures at the crack of dawn with the media present, these things that won't necessarily stand scrutiny at trial. In fact, are very unlikely to stand scrutiny in trial, but are used to predicate the pre-trial infringements of rights as if there is a case to answer, when in fact, you know, there simply isn't a good case with a prospect of convicting my client, which is the test for enrollment. There should be a case in which a prospector can say there's good prospect of actually convicting this person, so let's go to trial. Unless they can say that truthfully, it shouldn't go to trial at all, and none of these things should be happening to my client.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Stephen May, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Our next guest, Dipalesa Mpea, head of the social impact study at the Chikakulu Social Investments, asks a key question about how mines and innovators should include and support communities in the transition to better and more efficient technology. So the question, I guess, is to what extent is this issue being discussed in the industry right now? Dipalesa, welcome. Thank you very much indeed. I'm very interested to know why you've seen fit to raise this issue. Where is the exclusion happening here?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for the opportunity to be on the show. Perhaps, Jeremy, if I may, start with contextualizing the work that we do and how exactly, you know, we work with our clients in the mining space. You know, so we work directly with your social performance teams, sustainability teams, corporate affairs and CSI teams, as well as the trustees of these community development trusts that have been set up and share this common mandate for driving positive impact at a community level. You know, so this involves the strategic decisions that they have to make in terms of allocation of grants, the due diligence, the monitoring and evaluation, as well as engaging with community stakeholders. And a big part of that engagement is also working with an ecosystem of civil society organizations that work within these host communities themselves. And I think this is really an important, you know, conversation, because what we know from our work is that context matters, and we are dealing with some really wicked, nuanced and intersectional problems. You know, what we often see in the drive for innovating and I guess hacking away, and a lot of the social ills that manifest themselves at a community level, you know, that often understanding of the community, understanding of the complex nature, you know, of those problems isn't really taken right into account.
And if change then is just railroaded through, what is the impact traditionally?
So I think the adoption, you know, of that technology, right? So if, for example, you know, it is a solution that is aimed at tackling a youth issue, and young people are not involved in that co-development of that solution, gaining of trust, adoption of that particular solution will then become quite difficult. So, you know, there is really this trade-off, right, between wanting to see progress and very quick outcomes, and then in the end, you know, the solution itself not being adopted.
So how do you win that trust then?
So I think it really is, one, partnerships. So being able to partner at a community level, so as a system of actors at a community level. So we work with about, we've been around for 25 years, and we work with a range of actors, you know, about 2,000 NGOs that have been doing work in different pockets of communities around the country. And we find that that is a very important base in terms of engaging with community members and understanding, you know, the unique context of each community. So it really is this engagement, and it's an ongoing and not a once-off endeavor.
And do you think the mining industry is simply not interested in this, or is there a fear of the risk that might be attached?
I think it's a balance between, you know, both, Jeremy. So, you know, there is, one, the challenge of navigating conflicting priorities at a community level and the conflicts that arise and being able to navigate that. And, you know, I think that the mining sector recognizing more and more the importance of really partnering with communities. So from the onset, designing of their social investment strategies, for example, getting inputs, you know, at a community level. So we manage a couple of community development trusts that have community representation of in form of trustees on those trusts. So I think there is this growing recognition that this engagement is important, and it's a long-term game. It's not a once-off stakeholder mapping exercise, for example.
I'm going to leave it there, and thank you very much for the explanation.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Action SA President Herman Mashaba launching his party's manifesto this past weekend and says that he can create 4.8 million jobs and end load shedding in 2 years. He joins us now. And firstly, Mr. Mashaba, can you detail the specific industries and sectors where these jobs might be created?
Thank you very much, Jeremy, and good afternoon to your listeners. I think it's really interesting the job our economic team really did in actually giving confirmation of at least 4.8 million jobs will be created by 2029. Firstly, obviously, I think you need a legislative framework that can incentivize businesses to invest in this country, to deal with draconian laws, which you must allow businesses to employ if they can afford to employ. Unlike the current labor legislation where people are too scared to employ because CCMA is actually run by COSATU people, that makes it really very difficult. But a big opportunity exists with these factories and these hijacked buildings. Just to really give you an example, a practical example, Jeremy, of what happened in the 3 years when I was a mayor of the city of Johannesburg under very difficult circumstances. Over the 3 years, managed to expropriate 154 buildings, working through council, gave them to the private sector. And if you look at all those proposals, they were going to bring an investment of 32 billion rands in the city of Johannesburg. Those buildings were going to yield 22,000 permanent jobs directly through the construction phase. But then you look at the ripple effect in furniture and so forth. In the building alone, the construction was going to create 24,000 permanent jobs during that phase, because every proposal was given on the basis of how much are you going to invest if we give you this building, how many permanent jobs are you going to create, and immediately it was going to create 14,000 housing units. So this is just to give you an example of 154 buildings just in the inner city of Johannesburg. Now you look at the entire country. South Africa today is sitting with over a trillion rands worth industrial areas that are lying empty. Babelech industrial area, where I grew up, as a young person, anybody in Amanskraal who did not work, where those people who did not want to work. Today you go to Babelech industrial area, one of the biggest industrial areas in South Africa. 60% of the factories are closed down. The ones that are operating, even today, they are just limping around because COSATU and the Tapata Alliance closed them down. And those factories belong to us, people of South Africa. We know today China is very expensive to go and set up factory in the Western world is not happy. South African businesses, the Western world, we are saying there's 20,000-30,000 square meter factories that are lying empty. We say to a German factory, to say, here's a factory, to retrofit it, where you can employ people. Tell us how much you're going to spend in making sure that this factory can be in line with your production systems. How many people?
Herman Mashaba, I want to move on from that. Time is always against us, I'm afraid. You also have a very ambitious goal to end load shedding within 2 years. What strategies, what technologies would your party employ?
First of all, what you do, you professionalize Eskom, because I'm sure there's no South African who's not aware that Eskom is dysfunctional. It's a man-made problem by the current government because of the level of corruption. So you deal with putting professional people to run Eskom. Secondly, you deal with corruption. Anyone sabotaging any of our electrical or energy infrastructure, those cases must be treated as treason, because people are deliberately sabotaging our systems. Eskom has got to buy goods and services through these so-called BE companies. So we're saying to Eskom, you go and buy directly from the supplier. You don't have to buy through a middleman. also allow municipalities to generate their own power, encourage private sector investment in solar, sell whatever excess electricity that they generate. Jeremy, let me give you a practical example. Here in my own home, during the day, I produce more electricity than what I require. But what happens, because obviously you can invest in more batteries, this electricity, if you were working in a country that wanted to provide electricity that my house is generating, I should be selling it back to the city. The government is refusing this. City Power, they know I can sell them to more electricity than that they are selling to me during the day and use that electricity for someone else. So those kind of investments must be encouraged. But because we have a government with no political will, we have a government where the politicians want to directly benefit themselves and their political party. These are just the practical examples that I can give
Herman Mashaba, let me move on to the issue of illegal immigration. You've spoken about this strongly in the past. How do you balance the enforcement of immigration laws with the rights and the dignity of migrants? What specific policies or thinking would you introduce to ensure that there is humane treatment?
Well, you don't have to do anything, just really follow our current legislative framework relating to immigration. We cannot show sympathy to people who break the laws of our country. Because we are prepared in South Africa to be sympathetic to illegality, then we must pay the prices. That's why you will see ordinary South Africans not respecting the laws, because if government itself does not respect the laws of the country. So South Africa was built at the back of migrants. We must encourage people of the world to come here, but they must come here legally. When they're here, they must respect our laws. Let me tell you another example. Last night, I slept honestly with a sore heart. I watched a program, Carte Blanche, how people are selling children from Malawi for 5,500. I challenge and ask any South African with a heart, watch that program. And these are things that which I used to highlight when I was the mayor of the city of Johannesburg. 12, 13-year-old children are brought to here, human trafficking. 5,500. And for anyone saying this is good enough, we must leave these people alone to be exploited, South Africa to be at the epicenter of human trafficking, Action SA will not allow that to happen in our country.
And I'm going to leave it there. Action SA President Herman Mashaba, thank you very much indeed. And just before we leave you, our online poll today, ahead of an interview tomorrow with the Johannesburg mayor about the city's water woes, I want to ask you this question. Do you think it's a crisis? Do you think it's being resolved? Or do you think it's all about a lack of expertise? If you have a view on that, go to MoneyWeb on Twitter X, also on our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.